Welcome, friends, to Tanked Up, the podcast all about video games and craft beer. I'm one of your hosts, Ben, here with Adil.
Hey.
Hey, it's episode 447. We're going to drink some beers, talk about some games, talk about other stuff, see how each other is, and have a lovely time. What are you drinking this evening, sir?
I've got, from Phantom Brewing Company, the Nothing But The Truth 8% Dipper.
Nice.
It's got, yeah, the philosopher in me was like, wow, yeah. The truth. But also, sick art.
It's an interesting art. It's like Justice, but slightly,
yeah,
cycloptic.
I mean, it's a Cyclops Justice with the scales on one side and a sword on the other, but then the blindfold is below the one eye. Maybe it's a three-eyed Justice, I guess.
Perhaps, yes.
That would make sense because there are spots that would be eye cavities being covered by the blindfold.
Okay.
But nice. Its third eye is open, so just the same. I don't know what message that's supposed to mean.
This is exactly what I'm just thinking. Like, what are they trying to say by this? Have you got any flavor text on there? Or is it
no
just,
flavor
just...
text, no.
Okay, cool.
It just says Pilsner oats, wheat blanc, as malts, Nectaron, Sabro, and Crush as hops. And the yeast is London Fog.
Nice. Okay.
And,
cool.
Yeah, Phantom is Reading.
Yes. Seems. It sounds familiar, at least.
Yeah.
Nice. Cool. I am going to drink a beer from Left Handed Giant. I think I mentioned last week that they brought a bunch of new beers. As they do quite regularly. But this is Under the Moon, which is a hazy IPA. It's 6.5%. There's a ghost.
Huh.
Scaring. Anyway, with a big exclamation mark. It's not quite Metal Gear, but it's sort of, you know, it's an exclamation mark. This is a hazy IPA with Nectaron, Eldorado, and Galaxy. Expect an early quenching freshness of ripe melon with a whiff of a sweet meadow on a cool night. As this floats above, a fluffy texture and indulgent mouthfeel, signature to our hazy IPAs. Yeah, and then just as nectar, pear, and golden passion fruit, assuming the flavours that they're trying to go for. So I will get this cracked and we'll roll right back round to you.
Sure. Poured with just a little bit of head. Nothing's really disappeared since I poured it. Very hazy. You cannot see through. And again, I keep forgetting to fix this color balance. Again, it's more orangey than it looks like on camera. It looks a bit yellowy. That is a lovely hoppy nose, bit of citrus, touch of dankness, a little bit of like. Now you said passion fruit, so it might have been an earworm, a tongue worm, a nose worm, a nose worm. Let's never say that again.
I mean, even earworms a little bit, you know.
Yeah. It's really lovely smell. You really have to put your nose quite in, so it's not too fragrant outside of the glass.
Yeah, quite light.
Yeah. It's really nice and malty undertones to it. And a really nice hoppy bitterness. Not getting as much citrus. You can definitely tell the Nectaron and the Sabro in it. Yeah, it's got a lovely bitter, slightly malty back end to the taste. And leaves the mouth a bit wet. So you're not like itching to get more, which is great because the finish is quite long. And those hoppy tastes are just lingering in a really nice way. I'm wondering if the nachos I made earlier are dulling parts of my tongue.
Were they super hot nachos? Super cheesy?
I always put chili. They usually put like regular chili peppers, like jalapenos or whatever, but I only had the small green ones. Kind of used for curries, so I'm actually the biscuitiness of this It's really quite good. You can tell of the oats are part of the malt. So you get that like slightly chewy, distinct oaty taste, which I'm less familiar in a DIPA. It definitely, just remembered, I didn't say it when I was reading the can, I don't think, but it's an 8%. And I think we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. Boy, 8-ish% tastes like 5-ish% these days. Yeah, like people figure out how to just better mask that stronger alcoholic taste. And yeah, I need to remember that as I sip this instead of drink it. But yeah, a little bit of stone fruit on the foretaste. Really satisfying. I think it's the oatiness is a bit more fore than I was expecting, and it's playing a really interesting game with the hops. That is quite unique. I don't think I've had like a strong IPA that's got this oaty undertone as much, and I'm not sure how to describe it. I think I've just been a bit brain and tongue confused on what to call that taste, but I think it's just the interplay of those flavors. And now that my palate's getting a bit more used to it, like I said, that stone fruit and a little bit of like a tropical peak. Just like a slight, very slight, but not that tart, passion fruity. In the milieu. But yes, it's really good. I think I'll leave it at that. And maybe once I'm sort of partway through, my taste buds have recovered from the nachos and gotten used to this. I might have more things, but it's just, yeah, it's really good.
Nice. Good. Good. Cool. The Left-Handed Giant then. There you go. It's lovely. It's maybe, again, my color balancing, maybe a touch more orange than you're sort of getting through the camera. But poured with a reasonable head. Ooh. Well, that's a nice nose. It's very soft. Super light. Didn't get anything when I cracked the can, but again, getting close, it's nice, it's light, it's soft. Little bit of melon maybe on the nose, but not a huge amount. Like just a nice kind of candy sweetness actually on the nose. And it is very soft as a mouthfeel. Nice, nice medium sort of body. Very, very soft. It's like a slightly, not watered down juice, but a it's like a juice, but just not quite as viscous, basically. Really smooth, really soft. And that flavor's very nice. It's actually really strong. That melon coming through is really, really big. It's kind of almost edging on like blood orange. I wonder if that's the combination of the melon and maybe a little bit of the other sort of bits that are going on in there as well. As I said, a little bit of passion fruit, a little bit of pear. It's kind of edging towards that sort of blood orange. Not as bitter, but it's kind of getting there. It's got that sweetness, but a slight edge to that sweetness that's getting towards a bitterness towards the end, but very, very light. And it's a little piney, perhaps, as you start to get towards the end, but not massive. It's again, not dry. It's not really that wet either. So it's a very middling sort of continuation of the wetness of the beer, and the same with the mouthfeel, and the same with the flavour. It's almost like they've gone, well, we can make a beer like this, we can make a beer like this. Let's make one bang in the middle. But just give it a really distinctive kind of flavour to it. And it's really nice. Like, it's very, very soft. The flavour is big without being too overpowering. Lots of nice sweetness in this with, a touch of pine, touch of bitterness towards the end. I could see that, you know, see this being a bit of a bigger beer and having a bigger finish to it, having a bigger, bitter end on it or something. But at the moment, it's lovely.
Great.
I don't know if I said it's 6.5%. It will go down very, very quickly. I would imagine it's an interesting sort of take. I'd be interesting to get some brewers on to see their take on this kind of phenomenon now of 8% kind of feeling a lot lower and actually trying to, you know, how we could possibly go back in time and drink an 8% beer against the 6.5% beer from, you know, 3 years ago and see how they sort of stack up, or a 6.5% now versus a 5% beer from a few years ago, and see is it that everything has just dropped down that little bit, or it's just the way that brewers can make beer and the sort of the styles that are coming out, the techniques that they use, just allowing a smaller gap between those kinds of you know, what you're experiencing with an alcohol volume, rather than everything kind of stepping down, or us just being old and having drunk so many beers that now 8% is just like 6%, you know.
Very possible.
Absolutely. Nice, good, nice, short and sweet roundup of beers. We'll return to these very, very shortly, I suppose, and talk about them sort of towards the end once we've finished them. But we will talk about a few games this week. We'll get into the show, talk about some games. But
yeah, I also have to, I'm going to have to leave the room because I forgot. I haven't actually talked about the Beer Fest in the Netherlands.
Yes.
And I left my notebook from there with the list of all the beers downstairs. So I'm going to go grab it just so that we can, I can actually tell you, you know, not, oh yeah, there was this beer from, I think it was this place. So I'll be right back.
I'll dance a moment. Listeners will notice an edit. I wonder how much people pay attention to the ads and when they're coming back and transitions. Welcome back, everybody. You know, that sort of shit. You know, fucking is instantly so the kicked problem back with Twitch, in though, from the
you, is you can't do that because ideally the people, your core audience, are the subs.
Yes.
Don't see the ads.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
It's like a really dumb model.
I wonder whether, you know, again, for growth and things like that, do people actually push that or suggest that their core audience are their followers, to convert them into subs potentially? You know, I don't, there's probably a whole marketing thing around how to best do Twitch, but we don't do that. We don't fucking, I haven't got time to look at that sort of shit.
No,
cool. So we're back.
So that thing, why people have like the on a break splash screen so they can time the two together.
Yes, but yeah.
I don't watch enough Twitch to, I don't watch Twitch. I don't know why I said enough.
When Battlefield 6 beta came out, and it was the second weekend, a load of people were playing early, and I'm like, I'll watch a couple of people play. Most of the people I watched would put up a screen to say they were back, and basically they'd appear and they'd turn their camera back on, and they'd just have gone and made themselves some food, and they brought it back, and they're kind of just like, we're going to watch another person stream for a minute when they come back, and they're just eating their food, and then they switch back to theirs once they're ready to kind of go again. I think I like that Twitch is a very kind of interactive and at times community showing almost, you know, like, hey, look, we just watch this person for a bit, then we'll get going again kind of thing. Let's spread the love and let's just do some stuff, like, rather than it being a show, because we've got YouTube as the alternative to TV for that.
Yeah.
But anyway, yes, we're back.
We're back.
Yes. We will talk about some games momentarily, but yes, the beer festival.
Yes, so this is Bereft. Year 15 of Brouwerij de Molen's beer festival, and also the last one.
Yeah, I can't remember whether you mentioned this last year. Or I know you said in the messages that you sent last week that this was the last one. Do you know why?
Yes. Let me.
Okay. Is that something that we can broadcast?
No. I want to make sure I'm so. De Molen's not going to be around. Is the thing. I wanted to make sure I got that right on their website, but it doesn't mm-hmm. say anything. So they're no. So they're like brewery is actually a little windmill down the road from the location, which is like their storehouse, like literally down the block. But I found out through one of the people I know who also went to the Beer Fest. Apparently, the scuttlebutt is they can't. They're not making ends meet.
Right.
So, and the land they own in that, even though it's just a small town in the middle of the Netherlands, is like worth 2 million euro. Right. So they're, or at least it's worth that much to housing developers. So
sure. Yeah, like, yeah.
We're losing a really great brewery to land.
Nuts. Nuts.
Yeah. And yeah, it's really sad. And so. That's why last year was, there was a time between last year's festival and this year's where they knew the writing was on the wall and they weren't going to do it again, and they decided to do it one last time. Mm. Which is, you know, bittersweet. Mm. The festival was great. I mean, last year I think we went a bit harder. It was a bit more raucous, and I think my friends I went with we're all also in a kind of more chill mood. So, like, I remember last year we bought more tokens. You get like 10 tokens with your per day's tickets, and mm-hmm. we went for both days. And they had tickets from tokens from previous years. They brought, we ran out, and we bought more, and then there were 4-ish for this year, which we realized we had to use up, obviously. But yep. there was no rebuying. We kind of like. Got there. There were some train problems, so we got there a bit late, like an hour late, but still left at around 6 the first day. So like 1 to 6, and then we got there for like 11, opening at 11, and then left around the same time the second day. Mm. But we had already kind of had most of the beers we wanted, so that was fine. It was really good. It was, like I said, less of an affair than last year, but I can't tell that's just because we were more chill or because the whole vibe was a bit different, but it was good. I will not go through the whole booklet.
Sure.
But I will say, quick shout out to Wicklow Wolf. I had a couple of their beers and they're really good. They're Irish. Ulche is always good. I'm trying to find the one. So my big, the big winner for me by, there's two brewers I wanted to highlight. The big winner was Sacrilege from okay. France. They do brain. Wow, my brain isn't working. Is it mixed firm or is it just wild firm? Am I getting that confused? Yeah, it's mixed firm beers, wild firms, sorry. And they had one of the best beers of the whole place, I think, this year was the Jachère, rather. It's a Groot Armagnac. And it was this really lovely my notice. As good as you can say, as good as it gets. And then RFG, really fucking good. I take great notes.
nice.
But basically, we had, between the four of us, we had everything they offered, and they were all fantastic. They had a Cuvée Source 2025 Bio, which was a group blended with wild ales, and it was like, they're just really sharp. Mm. White grapes. Like you can really tell the sort of wine influence in their firms, and just yeah, really unique, and things you could was great on the really hot day, was still good on the overcast rainy day. Sort of the subtle vinousy, you know, tart obviously from the wild firm. And they had, yeah, they had a Saison, a Grisette, a blend of wild ales, a wild ale, and these two Groots, and they were all great. which is great. Like,
yeah.
So I bought a big bottle because, like one of those big 750s, and I'm like, I don't know when I'm gonna crack this because I want to share it with people, but also like. It's so big, so it's like next time I go to Bristol, am I gonna lug around a giant bottle? Maybe, but yeah, really stand out. That's
the just thing. Literally take it everywhere you go now, just in case it's
just
the
in case I find someone who might. Yeah. but yeah, Sacrilege is definitely the standout. I went back. I think my last beer was from them. I think just because I wanted to end on a nice note.
Mm.
And then the other one I wanted to mention, Hill Farmstead from the US was also really good. Levain from France, and a wild porter, which was quite good. The big problem was the comparisons were great from the French ones, because Levain was great, but like Sacrilege was great.
Okay.
And the other one I wanted to mention, which was a big surprise to me, was that they were even there. I didn't even know they were a thing. But Blind Enthusiasm, they're a Canadian brewery,
okay,
who does spontaneous fermentation beers, and they were fucking amazing.
Nice.
More taste forward. So, you know, I would say the Sacrilege was like much more reserved and like nuanced, really excellent wild firm. These spontaneous firm beers were not nuanced, but much more taste forward. They had the a thing called the Sapphire Eclipse, which was a dry hop spontaneous firm, which was just remarkable. That was my second last beer. I like was like holding on to those two tokens so I could have those two last beers that I'd had before, rather than trying something new, because they were just so good. And actually what was interesting is this was, like I said, the Sapphire Eclipse was much more taste forward, much more full, but was also a white grapey taste, and it just had this like big tardiness with like a cool sour burn afterwards. It was just like a really fantastic beer. You could tell these are not your standard fermentations. Like, you could tell this isn't some, you know, corporate well-massaged yeast, because it was like, what is this? This is so cool. And then it had an aperitivo beer called Mega Pink, a raspberry rhubarb mixed firm, which was good. But a bit, the rhubarb wasn't that much. If the rhubarb wasn't super rhubarby, but then the rest was kind of the same backbone as some other stuff. And then they had a single barrel spontaneous firm that was still. So somehow, like, they must have like not put you know, just enough so it got alcohol, and then but there was no bubbles. It was a still beer, and it was vanilla-y. And actually the stillness like allowed the, I think I in my notes put the roundness of the of the fruity texture really came out in a way that was surprising, because it was almost like sipping like a really fresh apple juice, where you get that like, oh, this is fucking apple, right? It was like that like full fruity nature, which I was surprised, because normally, I think effervescence like opens up flavors, but actually, I could tell the lack of bubbles was doing really cool things. So yeah, those blind. Oh yeah, and so it turns out these guys are based in Edmonton, the city nearest to my hometown, which was weird. I'm like, oh yeah, I'm a Calgary boy. They're like, what? I'm like, yeah. So the next couple times I saw them, I'm like, Berta boys. And it turns out, the guy started brewing, the brewer, young guy, at this like one of those places that, like, when I left Calgary, because craft brewing versus microbrewing was starting to be a thing, was just like, we'll be this place which has like a fuck ton of things on tap, like,
okay.
And then they started brewing their own house beer, and he started brewing with them. And then he, you know, left there, left Alberta, he actually worked at Cantinho for a few years, which explains all of the, like, why I'm like, Edmonton Brewery, fucking probably the best spontaneous firm beers I've had, like, as a collection from anywhere. You know, but it's like, oh, you, I see, you spent time in Belgium. This makes perfect sense. and then came back and with this friend of his, and they started Blind Enthusiasm, and I was like,
nice.
I can't believe. And so I told my friends back home, like, they'd never heard of them either. I'm like, oh man, but you're a 3-hour drive away. I guess it doesn't matter that they're in Edmonton. Boy, Canada's big. But yeah, Sacrilege and Blind Enthusiasm by far were the biggest standouts. There are other beers were good from other places, but like Alvina is always going to be good, Narc is always going to be good, but like those two, not only had I not heard of them before, but it was just like, no, these are like top shelf.
Nice. I really like the range of beers that are on offer. And I'd imagine, you know, you go to the next brewery along and you've still got pails and IPAs and a few other sort of things. But do you think that maybe the fact that it's the Molen and it's a more European setting, you get a wider breadth of beer styles?
Yeah, I will say one of the surprising people there was Theakston.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's all right. I think I blew the mic out. Yeah, I was so shocked. I'm like, what the? Okay. And they had two casks. And of course, one of the people, Martin, who's there, is Dutch. And so he used coins on Theakston cask because he's like, I don't get cask. And like, Joel and I are like, yeah, that makes sense. But it's so weird because, like, I'm not going there at all. And then, like, we had sips of his, right? Because we're all obviously trading sips. And it was like, yeah, I mean, we had good commentary and it was not bad cask at all. Right? But it was just like, Theakston.
That's a very odd.
Yeah.
Brewer to be.
Yeah. But because you're mentioning the breadth, what I will say is last year there was a lot more dark beers, I think, because that dark beers is like the center of the Venn diagram of the four people I was that we were our four person group, and so we had a lot of dark beers, especially that second day last year. And this year had a few, but like I had a couple, and there was just like there was like a couple moments of going to De Molen's own big giant selection and being like, yeah, give me one of your darks because I like your stuff and I don't know when I'll ever have it again because I probably won't. There was actually, Puhasta from Estonia had an Imperial Stout Rum, which was which had bourbon and Carcavelos BA. I can't remember what that stood for. But yeah, like there were some interesting dark beers, but I would say actually it's almost like everything got skewed away from the dark, because again there were a couple other places that were also doing sort of mixed firm spot firm stuff. And so to be honest, like maybe just because I might not be in the same IPA spot, but there were fewer IPAs or things like that jumped out at me. A lot of pale ales, but all good, right? Oh, actually, Brauerei in Stekkerig to Pompuzeke. I'm killing this Belgian place. Sorry. T P O M P H U I Z E K E. It was just too many syllables for my brain to be like, yeah, I think that's, you know, you live in the Netherlands, you can say this Dutch adjacent word, like, nope. But they had a pepper lambic that was really good. Jules' complaint was it wasn't peppery enough, because one of his favorite beers of all time was he went to a bar and they gave him this Quebecois pepper beer that was like whack with pepper, but I really liked it. I thought it had a nice, the finish ended up because of the way like good fresh peppercorns work, right? By the end of like they just sort of linger, and so as the beer started, the finish started to fade, the pepperiness remained at the same point. So you had this really interesting interaction where the pepper almost felt sort of separate, but not in a bad way, because it was just, it was staying, the rest of the taste was fading, and you were left with this light burn. But it took a few sips in order to like get to that state. So like a small sip, you wouldn't quite get that. But yeah, that would say it's one of the reasons why I was very keen last year to join the tradition. Because like Joel has been going since year two, I think.
Nice.
Which is 13 years of his life.
Wow.
Right? Like this was the 15-year anniversary.
Yep.
/ final. Yeah, he was a bit bittersweet as we walked to the train. But it's because the selection, the breadth of beers is much wider than any beer festival I've seen in the UK. And I think you're exactly right. That it's the, they get all, they're great, right? And their reputation means that they're getting a lot of interesting, smaller, but all across Europe. And because they're smaller, they tend to be more experimental, right? So you get things like Blind Enthusiasm or Sacrilege, which aren't like, I don't know about Blind Enthusiasm, I think it's pretty small, but like you'll get these very interesting beer companies coming because they know it's a place where other interesting beers are happening, rather than as kind of what we talked about at this year's Bristol Beer Fest, which felt very much like a, here are the menus of our beers. We came here to make connections and make people in Bristol aware of what we usually serve, rather than this like, we made this just for this event. Yeah. Or we made this really limited run thing, and one of the places this limited run thing is going to be is here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But yeah, so.
Nice. Good.
Great. Yeah, I'll have to find another beer festival. Man, my beer festival appointments next year are going to be very different.
Very open currently. Yeah. Yes.
Not existent currently. We've talked about.
So if you have a beer festival, get in touch.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about like maybe switching it up and going just like to different breweries in the city, like Manchester or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And the one thing that type of approach to going on a beer trip with friends is you lose a bit, use those sort of unique four festival things, which is why we're talking about it, because they didn't sort of happen in Bristol this year.
And not really last year.
Yeah, there were a couple, I think. But yeah, you're right, actually. Last year wasn't nearly as... because it was 2 years ago where we like spent a big chunk of that afternoon session on Saturday just waiting to get some really weird beers.
Yep.
Or finding out we missed them because we weren't in line 5-10 minutes beforehand. But going to the brewery, you also have their like random thing that's they've made small batch because they're trying it out as well. So you just won't get those like festival bespoke things. But I think that era of craft beer, with especially in the UK, with the lack of government help that came during the pandemic and stuff, I just don't think anyone's going to be doing that type of thing at any of the festivals.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully we can get back to that point where people can just sort of, you know, you're not just brewing for the monetary requirement to have to brew a beer and get it out and get it in front of the public. You can have that kind of small batch beer where you can go, great, we're going to this festival, we're going to brew like just one keg, or we're going to do like 200 bottles or something like that, that you can then bring with you and pour and make it an event. And, you know, ultimately, in my eyes, get people more interested in what you're doing by making a bit of a scene.
Yeah.
You know, come and talk to us. You know, you're here for 6 hours, spend 20 minutes standing around chatting to other people, waiting for our beer, and then enjoy it, talk to us. It will leave that impression with you. I think there's definitely something to be said for taking that little bit of time. And sure, it's the kind of argument of, well, you know, with current tax reliefs or rates and those kinds of things at the moment, you know, every brew kind of counts for a lot of breweries. So it's that kind of one where you go, well, we'll take the hit. Can we take the hit? Is this exposure? But, yes, it is. But can we afford? It's essentially marketing. How much money can we put into marketing currently?
Yeah. Yes. I'd like to think of it kind of like a, which is not contradicting you, but the long term. You're not, if you need, the problem is if you are so strapped, you need to make sales for this quarter. Mm. You don't, can't afford to do these long term. Let's like get people to like remember our brand and be interested via the cool things. We have to be able, modern capitalism makes it much harder for you to take the risks to do something cool and new if you don't have enough margin to let that experiment bloom. But that's like how craft beer kind of like exploded in the UK was mm-hmm. like there was a lot of people who had that space. One of them is Cloudwater, right?
Yeah.
And so what I found interesting was one of the beers I had was Operation Genome from Asvex Brewing Company, which was a collaboration with Cloudwater.
Okay.
And it was an Imperial Stout that was really good. It like started with sweet vanilla and like cacao tastes, but then sort of gave this like sort of flowed from just cacao to like more coffee and just this like full chewy great stout, and it was just a really interesting taste curve, and I was like, I can kind of see some Cloudwater bones in this. This was great. This was a great collaboration, and it made me realize I've seen Cloudwater collaborating with a couple of, like this past, like in the past year, I think I've seen a couple other Cloudwater collabs, and I was like, oh, I think they are spreading out their wings a bit, but instead of doing these like crazy every 2 months, we're going to release some fucking batshit dipper. It's like a more nuanced approach to doing the same thing, but working with a lot of people. But that means, for example, they had a small footprint at Bereft's this year. Sure, it was like one collaborating beer, and who knows if they planned or knew it was going to go there, but like, that's what collaborating allows you to do, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Like, if you remember those, the Fleek and Block beers that you found one of, the ones that, like, could go well together. Mix a little bit of this one into that one, or reuse the glass.
The blender type things.
Yeah, I can't remember what they were called. But ironically, you could only find one of them because they're paired beers, but under one label, one and the other label, and so mm-hmm. they were distributed by their distributors. And where you got the one, the distributor did not distribute both beers. And of course, that's like kind of comical, but
absolutely.
In that same vein, if you collaborate like with a bunch of people, especially in other parts of the country, it means that your Cloudwater's name sort of appears in a bunch of places. And if it's good collaboration, then people might be like, oh, I wonder what these guys do otherwise.
Yeah.
So, like, yeah. It's an interesting sort of take on, like, because if you're just releasing, you know, your own weird small release, then a pub or a bottle shop will get 2 or 3 12 cans of that one thing, but they also usually carry you. It's like, oh, but what if I do a small release over there where the regular distributors of mine don't work these people? Like, I'm curious about like how much of that side of the logistics and where the beer will appear comes into play on these collabs. Anyway.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that was Bereft's with Theakston. perhaps with special guest speaks to that. They're not like terrible brewery or anything. I just was like, I'm like, brain just broke. I was like, this is not what you said.
It's just unexpected, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Very, very unexpected. Yeah.
Like when I saw your shocked face, I clearly like had a visceral fly back to when I found out, because we were both like, but, and I knew. Anyway, another ramble about a beer festival.
Good, nice.
Tell me about a game.
I will tell you about a game. I won't talk long on it, for a reason I will that will come apparent in a moment. But I have been playing a game called Arctic Awakening, which from the trailers and the press releases that I've seen is leaning into that Firewatch vibe, but in the Arctic.
Icewatch.
And it is a news game.
Mm.
But it's a bit more, let's say, open than something like Firewatch, or even Everybody's Gone to the Rapture. It presents a maybe a wider box to play in. Mm. But you are a character that essentially crashes in a plane crash, and then has to try and find your way around, or find some people, or try and get out, ultimately. You're trying to be rescued. And you start to uncover lots of different things which lean more towards corporate conspiracy, government conspiracy, other people kind of leaning into these sorts of things, things that tapes that you find, and all of these kinds of interactions that you have with your co-pilot. Or no, they weren't a co-pilot. There was someone on the plane with you who didn't. They jumped out before it crashed.
Oh,
there's a bunch of narrative that's very, very interesting, and I think that I'm drawn in by the story enough that I want to understand what happens and understand the motivations behind what's going on. I am battered by technical difficulties continuously.
Oh no.
With this game. So there's been a bunch of times, and I don't know whether it's a new release on PlayStation. It came out on PlayStation 5 about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and whether it came out on PC previously. But it's presented in an episodic way, which, sure, I played for like 2 hours and suddenly credits rolled, and I'm like, what? I'm very confused. It's just ended, and there's credits, and then it just popped up the prompt. Would you like to play the next episode? Yes, yes, please. That's a thing. I don't know whether it was previously planned as coming out as an episodic sort of release, and actually they just did everything and didn't change that kind of structure to it and bundled it together. There is a little bit of time jumping between the episodes, so perhaps it's more to sort of suggest that there is a passage of time between each of these sort of scenes, because once you're kind of there is an element of slight time passing within an episode. You know, the character will close his eyes, goes to sleep or something like that, and then wake up an hour or so kind of later. But I have encountered so many times where I've had to restart a section of a chapter or a section of an episode where the character will clip, or you'll go to pick something up and they'll just move around the object and won't be able to kind of pick it up. And I'm maybe midway through episode three of 5 episodes, so about halfway through the game. And the character in the previous scene, sort of that the scene ended, and then it looks like the character's eyes have opened up, and I'm sat in the pilot's chair, and I just can't move. I can't do anything. I can't go anywhere. Can't get up. I can look around. I can look around the cockpit, and there's nothing to click on, and so I am stuck.
Oh God!
And I'm like, well, that's my time with this game done until there's some kind of patch, or I feel the need to go back and maybe restart that whole episode again and then just play through the sort of the 20 minutes, half an hour I've already played, and then get back into if it works again, you know, if it does work from that point.
A cynical take. It's cut it into five chunks so that you can only have to, like, restart a max, like, an hour 59 minutes when things go.
Well, it doesn't. So luckily, it doesn't even do that. You can restart the scene. So even the episode is cut into scenes. And I think by scene, it essentially just means wherever the game auto-saved. So wherever you got to a point.
Oh, that's weird.
And so the first kind of, and it's not the first technical issue, but within the first episode, it ended. And it was, the game does this thing where it's all in first person. And so you're walking along and you get to a place.
Mm-hmm.
But rather than something else happening, the game ends by essentially being just a disembodied camera that then pans across the rest of the scene. And I'm like, I'm not moving. There's no way that my character is flying currently. Oh, what the fuck is going on? They just continued the view out. So there's a bunch of choices in this which don't really make any sense. And it's doing a lot to try and pull me away from this game and not really think, well, it's just such a jarring kind of experience. But I kind of like the story enough that I want to know what's going on. Do I like it enough not to just watch a YouTube video for 20 minutes? I'm not sure.
So I will say with walking simulators, that agency feels light when you describe it, but I think there's something to be said about just the like virtual phenomenology of having to plod through a game that while you're plodding, you end up thinking more about, like, I think that's one of the, like, the things people don't talk as much about, but, like, if you ever, like, back before Walkmans, you would take a walk in the woods and all you have is your thoughts, right? Mm-hmm. And so in walking simulators, I think that, like, key into that same thing. Like, when you're just in a stretch where you're not hunting around for a specific thing, you're just kind of observing.
Yep.
Your brain treats that world as the world, right? Like, you think about what's going on in the game until something breaks immersion or, you know, real life, your brain's like, oh, no, hold on. There's that thing that you should be doing, and that's why you're playing this game. But, like, and I think, especially because the video game writing can even when, like, interestingly plotting, can sometimes not be as crisp as other mediums, he says delicately and politically, for no reason, I can say. A lot of video games are neat ideas, and the writing isn't quite there. And I think that when you remove that layer of sort of pondering as you're going and you move to passive, like I remember when you guys were telling me about Firewatch and I watched a few like gameplay videos but didn't want to spoil too much plot, and I was like, I don't know if this is that great. And then I played it and I'm like, oh, there's a difference, right? And like, and so I'm just sort of like, if you're on the fence about the story, I think perhaps sort of kind of paradoxically, watching someone do it will make it worse than it could be if you did it.
Yeah, agreed.
That's all, right? Like, and of course, I mean, where the fence is and how high it is obviously vary what you end up doing. But I just think that I just wanted to sort of touch on that because it was a realization I had years ago, and I don't think I ever talked about that. But just, I think one of the, especially for people who end up thinking while walking along, I think that's one of the charms of walking simulators and cozy games in general, right? You can either let yourself just think about life if it's like a cozy game like Stardew, maybe, where you're less personal. But for walking news games, right, I find myself thinking about the game world.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There's definitely a difference in agency, or it feels like there's a difference in agency with news games. You are very deeply inside a character's kind of head and psyche and view and perspective, that seeing somebody else comment on it or watching a video without having the active action of participating.
Even if it's just not when you push forward, when you stop, when you look left or right. It turns out that's like the heart of those games.
It, very much. And I think Campo Santo, you know, Firewatch is probably, and Everybody's Gone to the Rapture are kind of the pinnacle of news games. And I don't think we're going to reach that kind of ever again. And one of the things with Firewatch was that idea that it wasn't just the character constantly talking. There wasn't just a narration. There wasn't just a conversation always kind of happening. At times, there were quiet moments, but the landscape was drawing enough, was active enough that you were taking it in as you were moving through it, and you were digesting what had kind of just happened. Mm-hmm. And one of the difficulties that you get with a lot of these games, and Arctic Awakening is one of these examples, is they try and throw in more narration, more exposition, when you don't quite need it. Like, you could just allow the character to explore, but then they don't get the balance right, and actually they'll have like 2 minutes worth of walking or exploration,
mm-hmm.
but like a 30 seconds of a bit of back and forth between some characters. And then you're like, okay, well, there is some silence, but there's not really any difference in the landscape. There's not enough going on. There's kind of repeated assets. There's the same sort of stuff showing up again and again, and I'm just moving through the environment to get to this point.
Now I'm just wishing I had a fast run.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And you can fast run. So there's a difference in Arctic Awakening. You can walk, mm-hmm. and you can run. And why not just make run all the time? Why not just make that the speed? And just move at that speed. You know, be like, this is the speed I want characters to move through this game. Because there's also, awkwardly, times where you have to go from point A to B, and it will take you a minute and a half, but there's 2 minutes of narration and character back and forth. And so there's points where I've been like, oh, we've just cut off that conversation because, or I can't do anything because we're waiting now. I'm just sat waiting for the conversation to finish. Right. And okay, fine. My character's sat. They're resting. They're chatting. That's cool. But you want me to get on with things, but you're now putting a block in the way of being able to get on with things. Potentially cutting this into different chunks and redistributing it through the map, or at least having a... feels like there's not a massive link between the level of dialogue that they have and the script that they have versus the map design.
Right.
And where it's taking you from point to point. So yeah, it's kind of good, but sort of not in a way that I would
frustrate.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. This could have done with like 6 months of just editing. Ultimately. Yeah. Everything, a lot of stuff could have stayed the same. It just needed a bit more cohesion across across what it's trying to do, basically.
And fewer bugs, presumably.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yes. Many, many less bugs would have been nice. A smooth experience would have been good, even if there's a bit of disparity between that connection.
Yeah. GamesPew.com. I just quickly glanced at their article. Pew, pew. They sort of said, it doesn't overwhelm me with plot points. However, there's tantalizing moments early on that had my mind working overtime. Mm-hmm. Game hints at sci-fi revelations to come. Unfortunately, I wasn't going to get my answers. Why not? Because it's plagued by some serious technical issues. with the PlayStation 5 version, I experienced crashes, graphic glitches, and progress blocking bugs.
Yep.
They persisted no matter how many times I restarted the chapter.
Oh, okay.
Lack of a mini-map in the game didn't help. Starting from scratch with the PC version, I didn't experience any outright crashes, except I still ran into graphical glitches and bugs that meant I couldn't go any further until I restarted the game all over again and made a different choice.
Yeah.
So I stopped.
Yeah, fair. Fair.
So I mostly read that, not even for you viewers, but just like as a, hey, actually finishing this game might not be as easy as you hoped, Ben.
And I mean, as I think, as I sort of started out saying, I might, it's kind of going to be one where the game says there has been a significant patch issued for this game, which has cleared a lot of these issues. Cool. I'll return to it. But until then, I'm kind of done with Arctic Awakening.
So patch 101.0.6 went live on Thursday. And the patch notes said, mind you, this is PC. I'm not sure if they co-released on PlayStation, but I assume soonish. Fixed various collider issues that could cause players to get stuck. Fixed a certain ledge in episode 4 that wasn't supposed to be accessible and allowed you to bypass the scene. So nice. It looks like they're working on it.
And I mean, there is a. I think one of the good things about it is that there is a sense of freedom in that you have this box to move around and play in, and it's not just a corridor. You're not just following the path. You can go over here and you can climb some things and you can kind of get a bit higher. But that does make me feel like, how can I get around this area? You know? I think in episode 2, I was walking along and came up to like a gate. And there's nothing on this gate or around that had any interaction.
Right.
And I'm like, but surely I've got to go through the gate. The road has taken me to this gate. Surely I've got to go through this gate. And actually, what I needed to do was just go down the side road instead and continue that way without anything really telling me that that's what I needed to do. And maybe in a later episode, I'll come back to the gate and I'll be able to progress through. But you can see there's a little gap between the doors. So you can see through, and there are assets in there. So it would suggest that I can get in there. And I probably spent 10, 15 minutes trying to climb the walls, trying to jump the rocks, trying to see if I missed something and I could get through to progress the game, thinking that that is where I needed to go, rather than this random little offshoot path.
Is there much other obvious platforming?
No.
Okay.
Nope.
I'm wondering if they like forgot that video gamers have played platformers. So like, if you make something look like there's something behind it,
human will jump.
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, it's also one of my ironically, I think gates are one of my least favorite gates in video games. Because if you're like a hero or even just someone who's looking for answers or help, like if I was trapped in, it's the Arctic, Alaska. What is it?
Yep, the Arctic. It must be Alaska. I think it's Alaska.
Yeah, it's called Arctic Adventure.
It is called Arctic.
So I'm just saying it's not the Canadian Arctic though.
Probably. No, I'm pretty sure it's Alaska. I'm sure they mention Anchorage.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
But like, if I was stranded, etc., I came up across a gate, the fuck, I wouldn't like hop over it. Even if I didn't know how to hop a fence, I would struggle. And I think the average person in that type of circumstance gets over that fucking gate.
Yeah.
But video game says wall.
Yeah.
But like, speaking to that like immersive nature of walking sims, that's one same thing with like European assets things, right? Like, if you aren't going to have other immersive inducing elements to the game, you really have to make sure that these things are, the stuff you make isn't getting in the way. And like, I get why you would spend 10 minutes, 5 minutes trying to get over that gate, because what the fuck is the point of the gate?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not window dressing. And if it is, why are you putting so much effort in this window dressing when you don't put effort into window dressing? This is the problem. Even if it's a thing that you'll come back later, by making it in your direct path when the rest of things is kind of, you know, cartoon driving scene, that's bad, right? That's actually, like, via your assets, misdirecting people in a way that isn't, like, misdirection narrative misdirection, right? It's just, like,
absolutely.
But also, I looked at the Steam page, and I think you didn't explicitly say this, but you're not alone.
Okay.
You have a robot pal.
Oh yes, right? You do. Yes, you have.
How did you skip the part where you're stranded in the Arctic with a robot pal?
Yes, yeah.
A robot pal, Ben. I now understand why you want to keep playing the game.
A robot pal is a What is the, I think the game describes the floating AI type robot.
Oh God, is it ChatGPT?
As well, they are a court appointed like therapist, and you don't know why. You don't know this is it. And
that's intriguing.
This is part of the intriguing thing, right? There's lots of talk around some issues around the character's backstory. Lots of back
maybe
and forth
afraid
between.
Of Gates.
I think that's probably it. But the AI didn't suggest that. Nothing came up. They didn't even tell me how to go in a different way. But they're not a guide in any way. They are almost as clueless as the character is, kind of thing. Yes,
therapy
and it's bot. More there for potential therapy, and there's lots of open questions and trying to get the character to talk about the situations and things like this.
Right.
With the character then
when
just telling
stranded,
the robot to fuck off
someone.
A lot and stuff like.
Firewatch has your radio. They have your therapy. Bot.
They have it. I mean, you've got a radio as well in this, and you're talking to a character, and then in the second episode, you pick up lots of voice recordings from people who have been in the area before and stuff. So there's lots of kind of exposition and dialogue with other characters, but there is this bit of an odd relationship between your character and this robot that floats around kind of with you.
A floating robot?
And a floating robot, yes.
Do you have any sense when you start how futuristic, like, or the time period?
It's definitely.
Or is that like part of the mystery that you're
I mean,
trying
it's definitely
out?
It's part. It's slightly part of the mystery, but not something to try and figure out. I would say it sets itself several decades into the future. It talks a lot about LA. Not a lot. Sorry, there is a passage of discussion around fires in LA.
Didn't that happen in the 90s?
Well, from the dialogue, it suggests that ultimately LA does not exist anymore.
Yeah, so not referring to the LA riots.
So not referring to the very recent LA fires, but it's potentially set sometime in the future, but kind of not the too distant future, perhaps.
The world has had some shit.
Yes. Absolutely, and that could be
big or small
on current political discourse within the next 6 months. But potentially this is 20 years into the future. It's set in sort of the 2040s, 2050s, perhaps
something like that. I get you. Like, not clear, but definitely not now. But not like flying cars future.
Oh no, absolutely, no, absolutely.
That's sort of why I was asking when you said floating robot. I was like, plane crash and remote location.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not Star Trek times.
No, but there's definitely a like a sci-fi edge to it as well. And you know, you're kind of almost trying to find out corporate secrets in a way. And whether they're governmental secrets or corporate secrets of stuff kind of going on. But technology is advanced enough that there are floating drones flying around, basically, that look like robots. They're not like drones as we have them now with propellers and stuff. It's just a robot that hovers around, ultimately.
Neat.
But that's my time, probably, with Arctic Awakening.
So if you heard there was a patch... Do you think you'd go back in the next... Like, say, like, there's, like, a update in 3 weeks. Would that be too long for you to, like...
Yes.
Like, I was like, it sounds like the plot's interesting, but not, like...
If there was an update
I'm annoyed
the
so
week.
Much... you don't sound pissed that the game's breaking because you can't learn more about it. You sound intrigued and willing to put up with the game. And I know that, like... That has a slope.
Absolutely. Especially as in about 2 weeks' time, like Battlefield 6 comes out and Ghost of Yotai is on the horizon. Other games that I would like to play that are larger, I'm still bashing through Silksong, stuff that is definitely kind of taking me away from it. And obviously the longer that period of time, the less likely I am to go back to it ultimately. Because I will forget what has happened. And I go, well... I'm not going to start episode one again. I'm just not going to play it anymore.
Yeah. That's That's always unfortunate when...
Yeah.
Because it sounds like it was intriguing enough that you would have put in the 10-ish hours to get through all five episodes.
Absolutely, absolutely. Where's my phone? I can let you know sort of roughly what I've played so far. But the trailer for it looked really good. I watched the trailer and I was like, that's cool. And then actually I got an email through a couple of days later and I was like, yes, this is I will play this. So 4 hours is the chest I've played so far. I feel like I've played a lot more than that. Feel like I've played like 6 to 8 hours already. And maybe that's just because of those longer passages of time without anything happening, just wandering through the Arctic and you know, felt like an just how it's made me feel. Yeah, absolutely. And it brings me on to another journey I've been on, which is installing Windows 11.
Oof. Which the worst game.
Which is the worst game. But I felt like I should. So we've had a big, what would you call it? It's not a spring clean because it's not the spring. A big autumn clear out over the last couple of weeks. Did a bunch of gardening yesterday. Did a tip run today with all of the rubbish and a bunch of other stuff that we needed to get rid of. Clean the house and all this sort of stuff. And for some reason in my head, I'm thinking to myself, I should give the PC some attention. I should, you know, get rid of a bunch of files. I deleted a bunch of tanked up Audacity files, you know, freed up like 50 gig of space, deleted a bunch of stuff. Like, you know, my downloads files had like 50 gig of stuff in from, the last 18 months. So I'm just like, cool, spent 20 minutes running through anything that I'd left in there. Normally I'm pretty good at filing it away, but, spent some time getting rid of all that sort of stuff. And in the middle of doing it, the PC popped up, as it's going to, and said, you should upgrade to Windows 11. You know, support for Windows 10 stops in like 2 weeks' time. And I'm like, yeah, but I don't care. It's fine. Like, I wonder what should I do, maybe? Is there anything I need to do to kind of get ahead of this? Is there anything, you know, can I have SpyBot running in the background to make sure that actually my security isn't that bad and a bunch of other stuff? And I read a few articles that suggested that the Windows updates are on the OS level enough that third-party programs aren't going to protect you before the fact. And I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. Okay, cool. I download a lot of stuff, so I thought maybe I'll try and update to Windows 11. So I'm getting these security updates to at the OS level. Fine.
How many program-based things do you download? File-based things. We can talk about this afterwards.
I thought I'd update it. I thought I'd go to Windows 11. But there is... I can't remember what the reason is, but there's something in the chipset which does not allow me to... Yeah, so that doesn't allow me to automatically update. So I look for a workaround, and ultimately it's like, you can do it, download the ISO, run it anyway, see if it works. And I did, and it didn't work. But it didn't tell me it wasn't going to work. And this is the thing that a lot of things online say. It says, if it's not going to work, it will tell you it's not going to work. It didn't tell me it wasn't going to work. It just got hung on the install. I'm like, cool, there's something wrong. And searching online, I found this will hang on 46%. And I'm like, that's exactly what's happening. It's exactly what's happening. This is the problem. And some very nice person on a forum post had said, run these scripts, go into your PowerShell, do all of this sort of stuff. Cool. I'll do all of that. And I did. And it took me 20 minutes, half an hour. And it's installed. And it seems to work okay. Haven't opened any, apart from Discord and OBS and Audacity, I haven't opened anything else up yet to see if it works, but everything is working okay.
Man.
But it's just like, sure, that took me like an hour and a half, 2 hours to kind of work through and understand and find a USB stick. It took me 10 minutes to find one big enough to put stuff on. Like, you know. So it was like, I'm thinking to myself, that this wasn't a problem for me. Took some time out of my day, fine. But the biggest thing I find an issue with is that when Windows told me, when Microsoft told me that my machine wasn't ready, the thing it told me to do was buy a new PC.
Yeah, of course it did, because you need TCM 2.0.
And so it's just like, TSM, well, this is sorry. like it's a little bit, and it feels a little bit underhand that Microsoft Microsoft didn't say buy a new PC. That's not what they said. They said buy a new Windows machine, buy a Microsoft machine, get the Copilot enabled machine. Like, I don't want fucking Copilot. I fuck right off. Like, yeah. But everything is pushing you. And if you're someone not really in the know, you're going to be like, well, that seems like a good idea. I'll just drop 2K on a new thing because my thing doesn't work anymore and I need my thing.
Yeah. The thing is, it does work.
And that's it. It does work.
I mean, I think for the average this person is working. At home, for the average person at home, not getting Windows updates is not a huge security risk because...
Yep.
Routers that are shipped from your ISP will have decent protection themselves. They'll have a firewall.
Absolutely.
If you are installing random things, then the likelihood of meh code is pretty high. I will say, though, actually, browser-based injection has gotten much better.
Mm-hmm.
So there's still a chance, even because once you go, your browser can't protect you. It's not the same as, I guess, when I worked in IT in, 2006, 5 to 4 to 2010. Man, a whole career, a long time ago when the internet was somehow different.
It was new.
Well, no, it wasn't that new, but things that you weren't worried about. A personal computer getting fucked by a browser, but the things that browsers can do. The average person basically, this is why Chromebooks were such a great idea for light users in school and stuff. It's because you can have shit hardware. You just need to get the browser to get to a website. Turns out now, all the websites are so fucking convoluted, you can't use a shit computer anymore. We've just offloaded that problem in a weird way that made it come back with a vengeance. But I recognize more tech savvy than the average person, aforementioned IT career, clearly withstanding. I think a lot of people would be fine on Windows 10, even without the security updates right away. I say that, but of course, the next few months will be quite telling, I think, because I don't think everyone's going to switch. I mean, although the EEA, and if you're in the European area, which I can't remember if we're now technically part of it, but Microsoft is giving a year free of Windows 10 updates for people because Europe complained. So people in Europe get them, people outside of Europe don't.
You have to pay, I think, outside of Europe.
You get the freedom in Europe. Why I was saying this is, if enough of the internet stays on Windows 10, we will find out because a bunch of people will get compromised if there's big bugs that aren't, or big holes that aren't filled. And I think that's gonna be a big problem.
Yeah.
I'm going to go on another tangent-y thing, orthogonal track. That's right. I'm preparing my vocabulary for the new term. There's something super interesting going on with, I don't know how much you know about, software bugs and stuff, but there's bounty boards and, websites that help track. So application and systems runners will, say, if you could find this... tiers of bugs. If you find one of these and tell me about it, I'll give you this much money.
Yep.
And so it puts a bunch of there used to be a small cadre of people, and that word cadre is being said loosely across the world, who are very good at this stuff and would just bounty hunt programs. And then they find this type of thing. They say, you have one of these. Here's how you do it. And if that's true, they get paid out by the developer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Turns out AI, using AI, you can find these things a lot quicker. Or you can, AI will tell you these things, and if you don't know what the fuck you're doing, you'll believe them. So there's some really crazy, like, so it turns out there's a curl, which basically CURL. It's a Linux-based thing that, like, a lot of websites use, a lot of developers use to just do a web request from the command line to test a thing. Is it accessible? What am I getting back, right? And it turns out the main maintainer and creator of curl has said that, made a blog post a few months ago basically saying the curl team is getting inundated with these bug reports or security vulnerability reports because what people are doing is they're aiming AI at things. AI is saying, here's the thing. And they're trying to get money. So they're filing. And of course, curl being so integral, it'd be a big fucking problem because a lot of programs know that the system has curl and we'll use that in the back end, right? And so there's like, it's easy saying it's like a 4-person job dealing with the requests now when one person used to barely need to pay attention to it. But he pointed one as an example. And this guy says there's the highest level security breach because it'll do an overflow error and allow you to run your own code on. So just doing a curl request, which is literally just like, give me what this URL gives, will somehow allow that computer to take control of your computer. Like, that's a serious problem. And then he goes through and this person has a program. First of all, it's very clearly AI generated because it's got emojis in the report, which people don't do. But this program loads curl, loads another library, runs its routine, and then shows that look, this routine has exposed this type of overflow error. The routine includes setting a buffer, discharging the thing, and then reading out the buffer. Basically, this person, AI is like, I found one of these. Look, it works. And then this person ran the code the AI said, and sure enough got that error and doesn't know shit about programming, so then posted it expecting to get a big payout. Thing is, the curl library wasn't used in any of that code. It was just in the includes. So basically, ChatGPT create a program that was so shitty that it overloaded a buffer, and then it was like, look, the buffer gets overloaded and there's a security vulnerability. You made that. Like, nothing in the library was being interacted with. You wrote code that enabled the code to be exploited.
Yeah.
You've now shown a level 5 vulnerability in the code that you've written. Cool. What do you want from curl? Like, it's that bad. But the problem is, if you know what you're doing, because these things will... Basically, what some of the people were saying in commentary was... I realize I've been rambling. What they said in commentary was basically, the problem is that if you know what you're doing, you can get these AIs will produce a shit ton of trash, but there will be a couple that work, and sifting through those is going to be more fruitful than trying to find them all yourself, because basically they come up with 200 hits and 195 of them aren't, but you don't have to do any of the legwork on that end. You have to just parse these things, and then anything that takes it down to, say, 40. Or 60, let's be nice to the AI, 60 potential actual things that aren't immediately ejectable. Now you're looking at actually concrete stuff, and you can change the code and massage it and can be like, oh no, this is a big problem. But if you don't know what you're doing, there's so many people not the problem is, like, someone has to read these, and if someone says there's a level 5 vulnerability in curl, the curl maintainers have to take it seriously.
Mm.
But they're like thousands of requests when there used to be tens of requests or like claims, right? Like, just getting fucking rolled.
They're just getting battered constantly. Yeah.
Anyway, basically. So the reason I bring this up is actually, now that I think about it, this year is not like in the past, because bugs discovery and propagation of information about zero-day bugs or security exploits is probably much worse than it was when I worked in IT. I take it back. I think people, even though I hate Microsoft, why aren't you on Linux?
So that was one of the big programs that I use for work doesn't have a Linux application. And I'm sure there's a way that I could get it to just like
Proton Wine. Run.
Yeah, yeah. And I could.
Yeah, but also, I did think it's about work. It. You're not supposed to be... I get it, right? For a work computer, it makes sense. But also, it's... Like, what's super interesting is all the work Steam and the Steam Deck has been doing inadvertently, especially in your area, right? Like, if it's anything that's working on the graphics side support is going to be helpful on CAD side support and stuff, right?
Absolutely. Yep.
So, like, I guarantee you a bunch of those programs will now work directly on Linux thanks to Proton in a way that was unfathomable on Linux for all kinds of reasons. Or, like, Wine was always really slow and buggy, and you had to find the right Wine version that other people had, and there'd be weird bugs. And now with Proton and stuff, it's just like, oh, I guess things just run? Like, Windows shit just runs on Linux? Huh.
It did cross my mind. Absolutely did cross my mind. And then I thought, that, well, I've got like another 10 steps to do to get the thing to work, and I just need the thing to work now.
Yeah,
I was so just I've taken the easy option. Ultimately,
I also think that's if you were by yourself like a few years back, right when you were just your own company.
Yep.
Mostly because that meant that like you wouldn't be interacting with other people. So if you knew the file worked on your computer, it wouldn't matter.
Yes.
Those situations, I think. You just keep yourself
completely, completely, and again, part of that is I have had issues with transferring your files between different people and different programs and different systems and stuff like that. So I'm just like, cool, everyone's here. It
makes sense.
Unfortunately, this is where we have to be.
It's going to get a lot better, I think, in terms of support. And to be honest, I'm unsure whether Microsoft is shooting themselves in the foot, or rather, I'm not sure how much of the foot is getting shot. I think they are shooting themselves in the foot. They're also basically telling Xbox, which was all the profitable parts of Xbox and studios, doesn't matter how much money you make because we could make more money with AI, so we're still going to lay you off. Like, the company's not a tight ship.
Absolutely.
Speaking of gates that are being avoided, if only Bill was still around, you know what I'm saying? How's that for a segue to a callback to the?
He's long gone. He's long gone.
Oh yeah, no, it's been a fucking minute.
Absolutely. That seems like a good place for us to wrap up.
I was gonna tell you a thing. Oh yeah, my biggest one of the things that frustrated me a lot about Windows 11 was I used to like, so in my Mac systems and in I'd put the dock on the right, not on the bottom. So I'd often scroll down to the bottom, or the bottom of the screen, because I like hiding the taskbar or the dock.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you want to like stretch a window all the way to the bottom, or like click on some text right at the bottom. And as soon as you get sort of semi-close, the taskbar or the dock would appear in your way. And so I got used to putting the taskbar on the far right. Because usually the scroll bar it's not actually worse on some apps, but used to be thick enough that you could go to the side of the scroll bar, if you're on a document, click on it, drag, and you wouldn't trip the taskbar. You'd have to go all the way to the last few pixels of the screen to bring it up. And I did that for years. And yes, people made fun of me if they used my computers, but that wasn't that often, right? And then I upgraded to Windows 11. And guess what? instead of top, bottom, left, and right, it's now bottom and left.
Yep.
But, like, if you think about the most often parts of the screen you use is the middle, but, like, where's your file menu? Top left. Oh, I'm going to scroll because I want to open a file. What? Nope. No, I've opened the taskbar and everything's shifted over because the taskbar will bump the window, right? It's like, this is... No, the left is completely unusable. Can't I put it on the right? No, you can't. Like, well, I could do the top, I guess. That's still bad. But also, nope, top's not there anymore for me even to try. It's like, what a strange thing to decide to cut that type of feature. Obviously, everyone is used to it on the bottom, right? But, like, why would you... Like, what in the code process it was like, nope, it has to be the left. Bottom or left? Fuck the right. Like, it's just so strange.
Yeah, and I think it's the thing, as you sort of mentioned earlier, like, trying to go in and find a way to work around as well is potentially that little bit harder. And we're kind of getting to a point where Windows used to be infinitely kind of personable, and you could change things, and you could put things where you wanted. If it's taskbar on the fucking top, I can't remember which version that was, but you could put it anywhere you like. Like, and we're getting to a point where actually people are going, this is the product. This is what you've got. This is what you can do. That's it.
Tough. It's the weirdly, it's the Appleification of Microsoft.
Because
like that used to be the big argument was Apple just works. You don't have to think. But if you wanted to tweak, it's fucking impossible.
Yeah.
And now Microsoft, but Windows, if you know what you're doing, you can do whatever the fuck you want. Now it's like, there's certain stuff, if you know what you're doing, you still can't do it. Right? Like, because like, even when the taskbar menu didn't specifically offer these options, I think you could probably go into the registry and change things around. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can still do that with the taskbar, but like, you know what I mean? Like, the control panel used to be kind of confusing, but it had everything. And now, if you didn't know it, did you know the control panel's still there? Because there's no way to get there, because you have settings. But settings doesn't give you access to all the things. So guess what Windows 11 has? A control panel. It's just you have to hit start, and in the search apps for settings, if you type control panel, it'll show up. And that's where a bunch of the stuff you could tweak is. But if you look for it, it's not in your file explorer. It's not in settings. It's not in your start menu.
But look, so I remember this.
The
being
standard
thing
ways
with...
of finding stuff, you just have to know that if you type control panel or command R and you remember the fucking .scas, whatever. Yeah, no, what you were saying.
I remember this being an issue with Windows 10 as well, though. Like, they hid control panel.
Oh, yeah, behind. You're right. It wasn't just here, but like...
Yeah.
They've been doing it for a while.
It's been getting this way for a while. Each iteration of Windows feels that little bit more closed off to as you say, being that kind of customizable space for you. But not just customizable, but also accessible.
Yeah.
And being able to go into things and change things and, you know, how do I find my host files now? Well, I know how to find my host files, but how do other people find them, and where do you put your fonts? Well, who fucking knows? You know, when I download a new font, where the fuck does that go now? There's still probably a fonts folder, and you have to search for it. It's just not there for you to see.
It's not in the settings, and it's not in the file explorer. There's no way to get it. Although if you hit start and know you can just type fonts, hilariously, the first hit will be the fonts folder in the control panel. Because guess what? It's still fucking Windows. But the thing is, they're making the core like part of it hidden.
Yep.
Like, I think it was a while of me running Windows 10 before I realized, because I was just like, I fucking hate settings. I guess they just don't let me do this anymore. And then I was looking, something didn't work, and I went on a tutorial, like, just go in the control panel. I'm like, fuck you, go in the control panel. They're like, yeah, it's right here. It's like, this is so stupid. Why can't I just find it in the list of things or in settings, be like, in the stupid settings app, be like, no, I don't like your settings, take me to the control panel. Or better yet, just give me the control panel first. Like, it's the hiding of it, right? Like,
absolutely.
If it was like start menu, control panel settings, or settings and then control panel, or even in the settings thing, having a bit that's like, need more settings? Check the control panel instead of having to know or try. Because a big thing for me, honestly, was like, why would they hide access to the control panel if there was still a control panel? It didn't occur to me that I could just, like, run the control panel.
Yeah. It seems like an odd setup. Absolutely. And they've been going more and more this way for a while now. But I'll see how I get on with Windows 11, I suppose. Windows 12 will probably be out within 6 months, more than likely. And that you know, once Windows 11 support disappears, if it's working fine on my machine, that may be when I need to actually look at a new machine, as probably most people will at that kind of point.
Yeah, outside of security, though, I think that's the other problem, is because so much is done on the browser, and also, like, unless you're doing really intensive stuff like gaming, I actually think, like, when did I build this PC? In the pandemic? I happened to have upgraded right when the AM4 chips had TPM, which is why I could install Windows 11 ages ago.
Yeah.
And there was a reason why I'm like, ah, fuck it, I'll just upgrade now, which was a couple years ago. But, like, it's insane to be, like, this security reason that is, like, helps encrypt drives, basically. Means that they Microsoft expects the whole world to upgrade their hard drive, or their computer and their motherboard and CPU, from 5 years ago. Like, there are companies that have been running 20-year-old PCs, and it's fine.
Absolutely
right. Now, and obviously, those companies are probably still doing a thing, but it's just such a arrogant, but it's not actually the word I'm looking for in this case. It's such a bizarre take. It's like they're so out of touch with their customers that they don't realize how many of them run machines into the ground, but also their machines are so undertaxed for that they're into the ground is many years. They just assume that like in the tech industry, you refresh every few years, right?
Exactly. And the thing is, their machines are in the ground and they've still got like 6 feet left to go, right?
Mm.
They're still ready to keep those going for another 10 years.
Yeah.
I think this is the problem with a lot of tech companies, is they're like, well, they'll refresh every few years. You're going to buy a new machine every few years, so we're going to keep supporting that kind of cyclical kind of upgrade that you have. And that's what they want. They want you to do that because they are producing also the consumer goods to do that.
Yeah, but Microsoft hardware is not really where they make their money. So, like, I think it's funny that, like, they're so out of touch with their customers. I get them, like, saying, buy a Microsoft machine.
Mm-hmm.
That I understand. But also, they're so out of touch with their customers because the refresh on the decommissioning of Windows 11 is quicker than anything Windows 8, 7, etc. They're accelerating this time period in a way that they haven't ever done. Like, it's the fastest one. So this is why the European Commission, I can't remember what it was called, sent their letter. Like, they basically said, why the fuck is this half the time as when you did Windows 7?
Mm-hmm.
And then Microsoft's like, all right, we'll give you guys a year. But the rest of you, you didn't write us a letter, so fuck you. But it's like,
and I think I did read that they're doing something like, or they think, because currently Microsoft haven't actually come up with any price points from what I read earlier today on this extra year, that they would do it in a, you know, you get a year for $40, you can get 2 years for $100, or you can get 3 years for like $300. And ultimately, it's not like you buy more and you get it cheaper. It's so actually every year is going to cost you more than the previous year.
Right.
So if you want to keep it for another 3 years, that's fine. But it's going to cost you 300 $300, £300, yeah. €300, you know, to be able to do that.
I mean, I'm also, you know, not exactly the... I'm anti-capitalist, anti-corporate fuckery enough.
No.
Like, if I was running a business, I'd be like, yeah, fuck, give me those 3 years. And in those 3 years, I'm going to figure out how to pivot my whole business off of your fucking platform.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely.
Right? Like, thanks, matey. I'm secure for 3 years and then forever.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. Good. Right. I think that's a good place to finish. Fuck you, Microsoft. How was the beer?
One thing I'll say is make sure you turn off Copilot. And especially the... Oh, I don't even know
what
that
means. Is that in the settings or in the control panel?
It's in the settings. I think settings... Oh, now I don't know. I thought it would be... but because Windows 11 now has Copilot and I can't... The beer was good. I can't remember the name of the stupid thing that that like basically watches the AI feature, which maybe you can't use because you don't have the right chipsets or whatever.
Mm.
But the AI feature that like they got really taken to task with when they tried to, this is my fault for not having a browser open all the time, I'm going to look it up quickly. Recall. They got a big heat about this earlier in the year. God, it's been a weird year. Yeah, in April, which they advertised as Recall as a big selling point of only available on their new NPU-based Snapdragon PCs or whatever. So I don't know if you even have access to it, but Recall was a tool that basically takes a screen cap of every few seconds of your screen, such that a generative AI can then scan the thing, and then you could say, oh, what was that restaurant I looked up at 3 p.m.? Oh, yeah, it gets worse. I'm trying very hard to keep this short, but, like, it got so bad because it turns out people were like, that sounds like a huge invasion of privacy. What about password stuff? Oh, yeah, it's encrypted. Turns out it was encrypted because it was in a random folder and the JPEG headers were not JPEG headers. And so once you so the first version, I think, someone just renamed files from .dat to .jpeg and then suddenly everything fucking showed. Yeah, that's what it was. Someone viewed the actual file code and they're like, these are JPEG headers. So I'll just rename the file, and then they saw the whole thing. But it was also, it's true, what it was, the folder wasn't password protected or encrypted.
Right.
And then now they claim they fixed that, and the last time I heard, there were still problems. But Recall is just a thing, even if you love AI, I think it's such a security risk for all kinds of reasons.
Mm.
Everyone should turn it off. I don't know what the status of it is, because I turned off all my Copilot features. But I don't know what turns on, and I know I turned them off before they unrecalled Recall, which was also a very funny moment because they recalled Recall because there was such pushback. They're like, we won't release it anymore. They took it. They had a release candidate for the preview build of Windows 11, gave it, and then people were like, what the fuck is this? And they're like, it's leaving the preview candidate. Never hit the mainstream, but it's out now, at least some PCs. And it's insane.
That's nuts.
But this speaks to what I was saying before. Like, they're so out of touch with people and, like, even security. That's the baffling thing. It's like, you need TPM 2.0 on your chipset because security is our main point. But also, we're just taking screenshots of your computer all the time and then throw them in a folder that's not obvious, but also findable.
I mean, it's nuts, isn't it? And look, so many of these things are sort of like, you can have this, but it's on our terms.
Yeah.
We'll give you this, but on our terms. Everything is coming back to what a corporation wants to do and essentially being like, well, you can have this, but we are locking you in as much as we want to. Not that you can opt out of anything, but actually you can opt out. We just won't tell you how to do that. Fucking nuts.
System requirements. Oh, you need an NPU. You are safe. Because my tablet was one of the Surface 11s, and it has an NPU, but I got it for the battery life.
Mm.
Yeah, but It also just eats up your hard drive. So get this.
To be fair, you could
to
see...
enable recall, you need at least 50 gigs of storage space free. Saving snapshots automatically pauses once the device has less than 25 gigs of storage space free. Which means it just eats up your storage space. And you're thinking, I have no space. But it doesn't... Notice it didn't say it uses 25.
Uh-huh.
It says it stops when you only have 25 free.
Yep.
So on your 256 gig drive, mm-hmm. it'll just have maybe PNGs, I can't remember. I think it was JPEGs, but it's JPEGs.
Hundreds and hundreds, thousands and thousands of them.
Insane. And for what? It's such a, like, it, so in order for it to do anything, the screen, luckily training on Windows is probably reasonably good because it's such mm-hmm. a stable thing to train on, but like, if you use random programs that Microsoft has never trained their thing on, there's only so much, but it's basically just using the same, if you throw an image on ChatGPT and you say, tell me about this, it gets the vague idea, right? It's using that technology locally, because it's not sending anything back to the mothership, according to them, and that would be insane, right? But that means your local PC is also having to store metadata about that, presumably, or looking at all of the snapshots, if you say, yesterday, I was looking at Google Maps. What places did I look up? It has to go through all of yesterday's screenshots to find the ones that have Google Maps. But again, it's not like it's not storing facts, right? These things are just so it needs to have ingested that stuff to see what is the statistical likelihood in this 3 second period, this JPEG was Google Maps.
And it's storing a moment in time and a tag and a bunch of tags associated with that moment in time.
Oh, probably isn't tagged real time. No, I think that's why it eats up all that space. Because in order to look it up, it wants to... Because otherwise it would be building a massive thing over and over.
Otherwise
it's happening is when you ask the thing and then looks through all the JPEGs and does simple like image to text LLM mm-hmm. processing using your local NPU. But also local NPUs don't have like enough juice to do that. Like, it's so bad in all kinds of ways. I'm going to stop because
I think computers could be used for such good. But they're used to playing computer games and things like that, which we've talked about.
Wouldn't it be great if computer games were the only battery sucking thing that computers were used for?
Yeah.
Turns out we found a worse thing than Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Nvidia's happy though. Holding up the U.S. stock market. Oh, I'm going to start ranting again.
Let's finish. The beer. We'll return to the beer.
Yeah. It was really good. I liked it. Ultimately, not a lot changed. I think the slight tropically and very... The stone fruit came out a lot more. Mm. And I think I got used to that weird oaty mid taste that I wasn't sure about. Once I got acclimatized to that, I think the slight tropical and there's definitely the stone fruit came up a bit more. And some of the other malts, too. The oatiness, I think, was hiding it in my first taste. Still very good. Again, explaining maybe the last 20 minutes of not letting us stop was it's 8% and it didn't taste like it. At no point have I felt like having an 8% until I've finished and I've thought about how much I've been rambling about tech.
I mean,
it's part of the thing. I'm not.
Yeah, absolutely. That. Yeah, absolutely.
But like, good. It was very good. I still think it must be maybe 12 months, maybe just 8. It's just like something has shifted fundamentally in the way I'm parsing an 8%. Where there's so many, like literally, even like out of the pub, like this can't be 8%.
Yeah, absolutely. And
it's wild because. I don't know. There was no trace of sickly sweet at any point mm-hmm. in the taste curve. Mm-hmm. And at 8%, you're expecting a little bit of that alcoholic sweetness, just a little bit, and it's just not there.
No, that's nice. That's good. That's good. I haven't had something from Phantom for a very long time, so it'd be nice to try and search this out. Mm-hmm. Good. So for the left-handed giants, the beer stayed the same the entire way through. It was lovely and soft. pillowy, almost pillowy as a mouth sort of feel. Lovely and sweet throughout. Mm. That melon did kick in a bit more, and it edged away from that kind of initial blood orange sort of feel that it had. So the melon came through a little bit more. It was a little bit softer with some peach. And I think it just finished strong. You know, that piney bitterness kind of disappeared a little bit. And actually, it's a very good IPA. Lovely flavour to it. Just a really nice mouthfeel. So, yeah, solid beer. Good. So they're the beers and they're the games and the technology that we have experienced this week. If you want to talk to us, we are Out of Lives on Blue Sky. You can go to outoflives.net. You can find Out of Lives on the YouTube page. On Blue Sky, I'm Nova47, Adilis.
At the Omniarch.
And you can hit us up and talk to us about games or beers or whatever you fancy. And then come to our Discord page as well to talk to us about games and beers and whatever you fancy over there as well, if you'd like to do that. I think that is everywhere and it for this week. Thank you very much for joining us. We've been Tacked Up and we'll see you very soon. Goodbye.
Bye. www.outoflives.net